Hey everybody, Rob Maurer here, and today we have the good fortune to be joined by Alex Potter of Piper Sandler. Alex has the street high price target on Tesla, I believe, right now at $1,200 per share. And he just released a couple weeks back a 100-page report on Tesla. So we're going to go through some of the details in that report. Alex and his team have done a lot of research on the stock and the competitive landscape and things like that. So we'll go through some of that. And I think we'll just start out with some of the more current events. Obviously, Tesla's been pretty volatile today. I think down 13% this morning. I think we're down like 3% now, something like that. So it's been a wild day. And just the last couple of weeks, we got the Bitcoin investment and things like that. So we'll go through some of those things. Alex, did you just want to introduce yourself and then also the, you know, what, how the setup we've got going on here?
Sure. Yep. So thanks, Rob. Happy to be back again. So like Rob mentioned, we do have some institutional clients dialed in. If anybody would like to submit a Q&A at any point, there is the Q&A box, so I should be able to see that. Jess from Corporate Access is listening, and also she'll make sure I get the question. But yeah, I'm very happy to be here. We'll walk through some of the report, the rationale, and like Rob said, you know, we can talk about current events as well. There's always something interesting to talk about with Tesla.
Yeah,
so
for sure. And just to quickly introduce myself to, you know, your people on your end. So Rob Maurer, retail Tesla investor. I've been invested in Tesla since 2013, spent hours a day reading about the company, researching the company. And I've had this podcast / YouTube channel for the last 3.5 years or so, just trying to get good information about Tesla out there. So I've definitely followed it closely and like talking about Tesla. So yeah, so first things first, Alex, let's, I guess, you know, the biggest topic the last couple of weeks, I feel like, is Bitcoin. You know, Tesla bought into Bitcoin, they put $1.5 billion in. Since then, the stock has dropped. A lot of retail investors are wondering, you know, what's been the institutional reaction? Is this related to the Bitcoin investment? What are you kind of hearing on your end?
Not a lot, to be honest with you. Like, it was, I know that it's a big, you know, it's a big headline. It's not as though we had, you know, a tsunami of incoming questions related to Bitcoin after this announcement. I think to a certain extent, it's the sort of headline that kind of, to be honest with you, is a pain in the neck covering this company. And I, you know, I'm not gonna like break any new ground here regarding Bitcoin or anything like that. It's not a topic that I've spent a ton of time on, and I don't think a lot of people who invested in Tesla on the institutional side did it because they thought eventually Elon Musk might be using the balance sheet to buy Bitcoin. but it is the sort of thing that, you know, if you're gonna own Tesla, you have to be aware that these sort of unexpected, goofy headlines are going to pop up from time to time, and this is one of them. It's but like I say, there wasn't a lot of incoming interest or questions, and I don't think it does a lot to change the thesis, the fundamentals, or any of this, you know, that we wrote in the report: the market share, the, you know, the addressable market, the margin profile, robotaxis, all these things. None of it has anything to do with Bitcoin,
right?
And it's a tiny percentage of their total cash balance. It's a tiny percent of their balance sheet. So,
we'll see. Not something that investors have called up and been like, "What the heck is going on? Like, why are they doing this? This is changing my investment thesis." Not anything like that.
No, I mean, I do think people have their eyes open. I mean, they know that this is, like I say, I mean, it's a sort of buyer beware situation. You know what you're getting to if you're owning Tesla. Like, you're gonna have, you can almost for sure, things like this are going to happen. And I don't know what the next goofy headline is going to be.
Maybe Dogecoin.
Yeah, and Dogecoin, funding secured, all this stuff. Yeah. Like, it's, I don't know.
Comes with the territory.
Yep.
Yeah, and we were talking before we got on just too about how the movement in Tesla is not just isolated to Tesla over the last couple of weeks. You know, if you look at NIO today, the stock was down 10% this morning, probably down, you know, I haven't looked at it, but probably down like 3% now. A lot of this has been sort of a sector rotation, and it's not just been isolated to Tesla since they bought Bitcoin or anything like that.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there's this, I'm looking at like the SPACosphere on my, on my screen right now. And it is just, I mean, blood in the streets. Yeah. So, I mean, it isn't Tesla specific. I think certainly relative to all the rest of these companies, Tesla's actually outperforming. But I mean, it's across all of tech and the entire index. NASDAQ is underperforming. We were just on a call with our tech team this morning, and a lot of people covering a lot of different tech oriented stocks, and they're down big. But Tesla's getting wrapped up in all that too, but I don't think it's because of Bitcoin.
So in terms of just like some of that rotation that we might be seeing, what are you kind of hearing, or what are you guys, what are the prognosticators saying on your end in terms of why this might be?
Yeah, I mean, it's rates, right? And these really growthy, high-flying sectors. Certainly, like mechanically, I don't know how much weight that you actually put in things like this. It all seems sort of technocratic, but we value Tesla based on discounted cash flow, right? So a big input into the weighted average cost of capital is your risk-free rate, and the risk-free rate is treasuries, and treasuries are going up. And so just mathematically, that increases your cost of capital, it increases your discount rate, and it decreases the price target theoretically. Not do people actually, investors, make decisions that way? Probably not, but at least from an academic, purely academic standpoint, I mean, it makes sense. Especially for these sort of high-flying, growth-oriented companies where you're putting a lot of weight in sort of out-year growth, which you're doing with Tesla for sure. But like I say, I think that from a long-term standpoint, from a fundamental standpoint, a lot of the things that we wrote in the report, what we think Tesla's going to do in these various different markets, what their margin profile could be eventually, will be transitioning to recurring revenue software, high margin revenue stream. All that stuff is still on the table. There's no reason to question it, but
Right. That's not changing because the yield on the 10-year note went up 30 basis points.
right.
Right. So maybe let's get into the note then. So you guys, as I said, recently increased the price target. I think it was, around $600 or something before, and that was from a while back, and now up to $1,200. So I don't know where the best place to start with this is, but like I said, it's a 100-page report. So let's maybe get into it. We can also pull it up too. We'll have a sort of screen sharing. Bear with me as we flip over to that. But if we want to reference any of the material too, we've got that available to us. So, where do you want to start with this, Alex?
This is something that I know that in one of the previous iterations of this podcast, we've talked about it. This company, I feel like, has always deserved a big report, a transparent report that is like, there's a lot of people who are, they'll publish something after earnings, or, it's a couple bullets here, a couple bullets there, and this is what units were, and this is what pricing was, and this is what margins were, and publish. But you're getting now to the point where the company's part of the index, it's part of the benchmark for a lot of investors, and you can no longer ignore it, right? It's if you're ignoring it, you are making a call on it. So you, especially if you are the type of investor who benchmarks against the S&P 500, so you have to understand it. And if it's going to be as large a percentage of the benchmark as it is, you need to make an honest effort to understand all line items. And obviously, we could be completely off the mark on a lot of our longer term forecasts, but people need to understand why the stock has behaved the way that it's behaved. What is the bull thesis? And after the S&P 500 inclusion decision, we did have a lot of inbound, specifically from portfolio managers who were trying to understand, maybe for the first time, right? This, like, I've been perfectly happy to ignore this company for my entire career, but now I can't do that anymore, and so I need to understand it. And so it took a long time to write it, and there's a lot of it's, generally speaking, it's a sort of a hyper rational approach to going through all the different components of the P&L. How big is the automotive market in the US, in China, in Europe? How big are each of the main segments in the US, in China, in Europe? What is a realistic market share that Tesla could get? multiply that by a realistic price, do this for every one of their models, then layer in software, what's a defensible take rate, how many people are going to be opting in to the full self-driving package, what's the pricing likely to be, how many are going to be subscriptions, how many are going to be lump sum. So it's very detailed, and we go into all of those, and then we sort of put it all together and have a big DCF that values that whole revenue stream at the margin profile. We do the same for energy. I know we've talked a little bit in the past about how we forecast the energy business. And now we have it sort of all in one place, which we never had before. It was just like tons and tons of these different reports sort of scattered all over the place. And now it's sort of this big compendium, and over time we can continue adding to it. Whenever we publish something proprietary, we've done a lot of work in the past on the Tesla Semi, ROI work on the Tesla Semi, or market share in China, or different things. We can sort of add a chapter to it, and then just keep it going.
Right.
So yeah, I don't exactly know where to start with it either. Any of the one thing I would say for sure that a lot of people want to understand better, and I for good reason is software full self-driving. We got a couple questions on that when we were sort of soliciting Q&A topics prior to this. And that is a huge part. Like, if you don't, one thing I would be more or less willing to say for sure is if you don't believe that full self-driving is a thing and that Tesla will be able to monetize it above and beyond what they're doing now, then you can't own the stock. Like, I think that's a fair assessment because the margin implications of a mix shift towards software, are so large that eventually it overwhelms the entire P&L. So you need to at least wrap your head around that concept and try to understand how to model it. So we spent a fair amount of time in the report going into that.
Okay. I think that'd be a really good place to start because, in general, I would agree. I don't think anyone's valuing Tesla right now at, $600 billion, $750 billion dollars based on their ability to sell electric vehicles alone. There's a question of how much full self-driving comes in. Like, do they need to be a fully autonomous robotaxi service to justify the valuation? Do they need to just continue to sell it as a $10,000 option and, be sort of halfway there? I think there's a lot of, variability in there too. So yeah, let's take a look at what you've got. So I'm gonna flip over here. We'll share the screen. Hopefully this works okay. So give me a second. Okay, so I've got that shared over with Alex. And we're flipped over here now on the live stream. Is that coming through okay for you, Alex?
It looks good to me.
Great. Okay,
Let's
so
think.
yeah, so I'll just scroll through here. Do you have
Yeah,
any idea
I
what page
think
that the FSD stuff starts on?
probably like 64, 64 or 63, 64.
So here's
Yeah, so
revenue.
that's revenue contribution. So this is based on our forecast. So you can see, in the first, call it till the mid 2020s, selling cars is the, and that's what most people think of when they think of Tesla, right? It's the how many units are they going to sell? What's their market share? Multiply units by price, and you get revenue. Part of the issue here is, and you have batteries and solar also up there, which has more or less been starved of capacity because of battery supply constraints. So if they're even in the right zip code, I think they were still talking about being on track to be at something like 200 gigawatt hours of battery cell capacity by the end of 2022. Like, we're significantly under modeling that. And I guess it will be great if they stay on course. Even in the automotive part of the business, right? We're modeling 9 million units by 2030, which is a lot. That would be, putting them in top three sort of category within a decade, but it's still far below what their ambitions are, at least if you back calculate based on their own battery capacity plans. So anyway, those are the main, in the near term, next several years, it's automotive. But you can see then starting in the mid to late 2020s, revenue from full self-driving starts to increase. And there's no magic behind this either, in the sense that I can't really specifically defend why we think full self-driving penetration is going to ramp in the late 2020s or the mid 2020s versus, versus today, right? At
Right.
least if you, I mean, certainly Elon Musk's ambitions seem to suggest that things are going to ramp a lot faster than the way that we are assuming here. There's actually a let's see. I don't know if people necessarily want to get this far into the weeds, but if you
We've got
go,
time. Let's do it.
yeah, there's so if you go to page 84, there are appendices. Tons and tons and tons of appendices. Like this is the analysis that backs up our full self-driving forecast. So this table that you're looking at here, this like waterfall chart or whatever you call it, it's just the total number of vehicles that are in the active fleet that are capable of accepting full self-driving. Not all of them are going to have it, right? Some people are going to opt out and maybe in the future opt in. So that gives you, basically a picture of the total addressable market that could potentially use it. And then if you keep scrolling down to all of those next slides, there's each of these is a subset, right? So this is the number of vehicles within that who decided to buy full self-driving upfront as a lump sum. And then if you go down again, right, then there's people who decided to buy upfront, but not as a lump sum, as a subscription instead. Right, so they're going to presumably in the next couple months, or at least that's what they've said, they're going to have a full self-driving subscription. They haven't talked about price or anything like that, but anyway, if you look at the report, like I said, this gets super far into the weeds. Like there's page after page after page after page of these charts, like scrolling down and down and down. This is the number that don't versus the number of do, the number of cars that do have full
Post-purchase
self-driving.
upgrades.
Yep. So that's the other thing. Like you have to make explicit assumptions about all these things. How many people buy full self-driving upfront? How many people buy it as a lump sum? How many people buy it as a subscription? How many people don't buy upfront, but then later decide that yes, they want to? And of those, were they buying it as a subscription or buying it as a lump sum? And so, like, it then you have to make pricing assumptions for all that. And so like I said, it took us a long time to sort of wrap our head around what all the assumptions are that we wanted to make, and then put them into the model in something that resembled a palatable and digestible product. And so basically the summary of it is on page 65 and 66.
Okay, let me flip over there.
And you can see the basically all of the core assumptions that go into it. So
So this is basically a summary of all of those waterfall charts that we just looked at.
right.
Okay.
Those are the underlying assumptions. So percentage of new buyers that are buying full self-driving upfront using lump sum payment, and then there's a percentage, right? And then blah blah blah
Then you've got the pricing
blah blah. So
there.
right. And so like truly getting into this is probably not like podcast material. It's probably like take a screenshot of this and then sit there all night, like tearing your hair out.
Right.
But
But let me just call out a couple of interesting things that I'm seeing in here. So
yeah.
basically, and I think people are aware of this from when the note came out, but basically you're forecasting the lump sum price of, the full self-driving package to increase over time right now from $10,000 to eventually in 2030, $30,000, and then 10 years later, $39,000. Then similarly with the full self-driving subscription, you're having that start out at $175, eventually up to like $680. And then it looks
Per
like
month.
in terms of the take rates, you're forecasting somewhere between, a third in 2030, and this would be across lump sum, subscription, whatever, right?
Yep.
So you're forecasting that up to like 30, a third of the vehicles, and then just over half in 2040. So what I think is interesting about this is the assumptions that are in here. You could make arguments about the average selling price, sure, but I think you're being pretty conservative here in terms of the opt-in rate, I would say, because if there is like full autonomy, if that gets achieved, then at least Elon Musk would argue that, it'd be stupid not to do it because you're just kind of throwing away money. And maybe even
Right.
Tesla wouldn't even put vehicles in the fleet without mandating that someone either has a subscription or, pays that lump
Yeah.
sum payment. So that's where it's like you still have this $1,200 price target, but you can make more bullish assumptions here. And like you said, you're at 9 million, Tesla's targeting 20 million. And yeah, that's their own forecast. Like you want to do your own forecasting and stuff, but that's what I find fascinating about it is there is still a bunch of upside. Obviously, there's tons of downside. Like if Tesla doesn't hit, if they never get full self-driving, then it's not going to happen like this, obviously.
Yeah.
But that I don't know. That's one of the things I find interesting right off the
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's
bat.
I hear that. I hear you. Like there is, I think a halfway believable version of the world in which this forecast is like wildly optimistic and there were people who, when we published it, were just like, no, like it's too expensive. Like think of how much it costs people to, in the end, if you're buying a $39,000 option and this is a, $30,000 car, then, that's 30 plus 40 is 70 grand, and people don't buy $70,000 cars, or at least it's a small addressable market. And so you have to sort of walk through like why it is a believable version of reality, the way that we have it modeled. And it's true. Like, well, first of all, it isn't, we aren't modeling 100% take rates. There are still, whatever, 45%, even at the end of the forecast period, who are not opting in. And we also have vehicles, Tesla's selling $20,000 vehicles by the end of this forecast. And that's, 2 decades in the future. $20,000 means something different than what $20,000 means today. Like if
A
you look
lot
at what the
different.
average MSRP is for a vehicle today in the US, it's in the mid 30s. And if you look 20 years ago at what the average was, just because of inflation, right? And so selling a $20,000 car in 2040 is nothing to sneeze at. Like the actual all-in price that people are paying, like you can buy a ridiculous car, at least based on this, for a very low price. So we're not actually assuming that people are spending like just unimaginably high amounts on transportation. At least not everybody.
Well, and
But
even here, 9 million vehicles, that would put Tesla at a little bit over 10% market share. Like, that's not anything super, super high, especially if they're in those price bands.
right. Yeah. So, but again, like, and so if this is, remotely accurate, right? Or, I think there are, like you say, certain, if you're looking at this, through sort of rose-tinted glasses, you could argue that it's actually quite conservative the way that we're setting it up. Then, what's happening with the treasuries today, 30-year treasury rates, or what, like it completely misses the forest for the trees. But like I said, this stuff in the overall scheme of the Tesla thesis is really, really core. Like it's probably more core than whether Tesla sells 9 million versus 15 million vehicles. And so, or 4 million, right? The other thing too that a lot of people point out when they're trying to poke holes in this is the China take rates. right? So the FSD take rates right now in China are like low single digits, like 1 or 2%. And I wish that they would disclose this more regularly. All we really have to go off of is a couple data points and a couple breadcrumbs that they've given us historically regarding what the take rates were. A lot of that is prior to the Shanghai Gigafactory ramping up. So it's possible that our starting point for these take rates is, many, many hundred basis points too high. But I don't know for sure. You can probably back into some numbers and defend them. So that's something I try to be cognizant of. And there are other things too. Like I was just yesterday listening to this Ouster Analyst Day from they're one of these, LiDAR SPACs, and people talking about LiDAR, whether eventually LiDAR will be mandated by regulators, yes or no. And obviously Elon Musk has a well-documented stance on what he thinks of LiDAR, and whether at some point LiDAR becomes, incredibly cheap and very reliable and high quality. And if Tesla's hardware package has evolved that far down the path without LiDAR, like how quickly can they pivot? Can they pivot? Blah, 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 blah. So there are also reasons why, people look at this forecast and think it's completely bogus. But it is really important to the thesis. So that's why we spent the amount of bandwidth that we did on this topic. I don't know. I mean, what do you think? Like, do you think that if you put Waymo and Cruise and Tesla and whoever else, right, into this big self-driving ecosystem, I know that Tesla has the big active population of vehicles out there collecting real world data, which is something that other people don't have. Other people are running simulations, which simulated data is not as good as real world data. So that's something Tesla has going for them for sure, which I can understand as a layperson. I don't know on the whole LiDAR versus non-LiDAR stuff. I think Elon Musk maybe has a different definition of what safe enough means. He's also the sort of person who would, without a second thought, get on a spaceship to Mars. So, like, that's one of
He
the
has a
arguments
higher
that Elon.
risk tolerance than most people, I would say.
Yes, I think that is a most people would likely agree with that.
So a couple thoughts there. So, I mean, first of all, just on the research here, like I think it's really important to have stuff like this out there, not even to just say like, oh, this is exactly what's going to happen in the future, but just to understand like the context of what is possible and what could be possible if Tesla achieves the things they're targeting to achieve. Because like you said, this is supposed to be sort of a guide to investing in Tesla or a guide to at least understanding the stock price of Tesla. And things like this are what the bullish side of Tesla are thinking about. We're thinking about, okay, how many vehicles cumulatively is Tesla going to have delivered in 2030? And if Tesla achieves, even level four full self-driving by then, how much recurring revenue can that, 50 to 100 million vehicles generate from that technology? And it's a lot, and it's super high margin revenue. And if they get there, the stock's undervalued today, pretty much no matter what you put in these forecasts, no matter what the take rate is, no matter what the ASP is, it's pretty much undervalued if that scenario like that happens. And I think when you map it out like this, it makes that pretty clear. Why that's important is because then you can say, okay, well, I don't think that's going to happen. I'm not going to invest in Tesla, like you said. Or, hey, I do think that's going to happen because Tesla seems to be the leader. They have the biggest fleet. They're collecting the most data. They have the best, driving assistance package available today, that can work in the most number of situations. So there's a lot of reasons there to say to support, Tesla taking a big part of that market and achieving some sort of technology that is worth a lot of money. Because even today, without it being fully autonomous, it's still adding a ton of value to Tesla. Like they're making, if we assume like a 20% take rate, that's adding $2,000 in almost pure margin on every vehicle they sell. No other automaker is doing anything like that, like not even close. So
Yes.
that's kind of my thought on just like the scenario and, how it And I guess to extend that a little bit further, if we assume that $2,000 on, you know, every vehicle, and then we say 50 million vehicles in 2030, that's like $100 billion of extra profit that Tesla's got to work with. And they can put that into, you know, I think you have CapEx modeled out in here too, but they can put that towards their 3 terawatt hour goal, and that would pretty much pay for their, you know, the battery production that they would need to get through 2030 to be able to build 20 million vehicles a year, and also, you know, a terawatt hour of battery energy storage. So those are kind of my thoughts on that part of it. As for the actual technology, and I guess I touched on this too. Yeah, Elon's been very clear. He's not interested in LiDAR. I think his reasoning makes sense. You know, I'm not the technical expert there by any means, but he's basically saying you can't have one without the other. You can't have full self-driving without having vision that's good enough to understand and interpret the environment well enough to be able to navigate through it. So if you're going to have vision that's good enough to do that, why do you need LiDAR? He's gone as far as saying that they wouldn't even put LiDAR on the car if it was free because of that.
Yeah,
It just
I thought that was a good
adds.
one on the last earnings call. I
Yeah.
like that question.
I think it might have been Adam Jonas that asked that. But yeah, that was an interesting question, and you know, I don't know that Tesla wouldn't do that. It might be good for redundancy, and it might help them learn a little bit more quickly. But Elon always thinks in kind of like first principles, end state, what can we accomplish with this technology? And you know, he believes, I think for well-founded reasons, that they can get vision, the understanding through the neural network of the vision of the environment with vision, good enough to where they can navigate through it with their car. So I tend to believe that. As for the timeline, who knows? But I think Tesla's positioned very well to get there first. And, you know, when I come down to it, the core of my bull thesis is, you know, that's a big part of it. The other part is just, you know, Tesla's one of the most innovative companies we've ever seen in the entire world. So there's just a lot of value in owning a company that does that. But
That I think is the real, like there's while on the one hand you're right, you know, the sort of the way that you had laid out our rationale and the spirit behind this report was to be as a tool, a guide, right? And we'll lay out the assumptions, and if you think I'm smoking crack, then put your own assumptions in there and it'll be a different price target
right.
and the underweight Tesla. And so I at least wanted to set it up mechanically in a way that would identify what the core assumptions are and come up with a valuation. But the stuff you just talked about there, just the innovation side of it is something that defies quantification to a certain extent, in the same way that, you know, the iPhone would have defied quantification if you were trying to assess the value of Apple based on their market share in the PC market or something in the 90s. Like nobody at the time knew what an iPhone was or what an iPod was, right? And so it was sort of nonsensical to try to articulate it at the time. All you knew was that, you know, Steve Jobs, this guy, he could sense where these opportunities are. And as I look through sort of this big report, there are monster addressable markets that we didn't touch on, like the analogy on the energy side. So we do model out the hardware side of energy of solar and storage, right? It's similar to automotive market share, right? There's a market, and you sell a piece of metal into the market, and you get paid for selling that metal, and then you earn a certain margin on it. It's just an industrial revenue stream. And we wrap our heads around how big that market could be and defend sort of why, how many gigawatt hours are they selling every year in storage, and how many solar rooftops are there, and things like that. But there's a software analogy in that market too that we have not attempted to quantify, mainly because I just don't know anything about it. And it's like one more thing to add to the to-do list. But this, whatever they call it, auto bidder, or you know, it's trying to optimize the grid. So when do you generate, when do you store, how do you shift these electrons around based on the optimal, you know, pricing and demand and supply, and trying to balance everything out. Like, what is that worth to utilities? What is that worth to end users? Just like the self-driving software stuff is worth to a fleet operator, or what is it worth to you as a consumer to not have to go grocery shopping ever again because your car does it for you, or pick your kid up from soccer practice or something. Like, what is that worth? Well, there are goofy little opportunities like that all across these end markets that Tesla's touching that they can sense and monetize. And I don't have them yet in the model, but they're always out there. And like that Octoval stuff in HVAC was another one, right? There's literally probably a half dozen different things that aren't included, but just because they are set up in the way that they're set up and they have the management philosophy, this sort of first principles, hyperlogical approach to attacking these different, old school 20th century industries. He's done this over and over and over again. People, if he hadn't been forced to sell PayPal, then the worldwide financial industry would probably be completely different than it is today. He's doing it with aerospace, and he's doing it with energy, and he's doing it with cars. And so, to a certain extent, there is an investor base out there who, rather than trying to get too far into the minutia, right, pulling out these multi-megabyte Excel spreadsheets and trying to understand why you put that assumption in 2032, they just say, I mean, it's like on the back of a bar napkin or something, be like, how big is this chunk of the economy? How big is that chunk of the economy? What share is Tesla likely to get? That's all I need to know. Like there's a handful of people like Steve Jobs and Elon Musk, and you place your bets. And so there's definitely that element of it in there too.
Just a couple thoughts on that. So, I mean, I like to understand the minutiae and like these details. I love looking at these forecasts out to 2040 and looking at like every single line item. But how I think about Tesla is mostly towards that latter state of just like, here's the addressable market. Here's why I think Tesla is leading in these areas. So if they continue to lead, eventually the company's going to be doing X amount in revenue. They should be able to get Y margins. And there you go, multi-trillion dollar valuation. Okay, Tesla's a $30 billion company, a few years ago. I'm going to hold the company. Now it's, $600 billion, but I still believe there's that super clear path to, multi-trillion dollars of opportunity. So yeah, I'm going to continue to hold the company. And I think that's a lot of retailers approach it that way. And now I think as you said, it's coming to the institutional space more with the S&P inclusion. People need to start to understand it. And there's probably a little bit of that like push and pull of, the numbers, the fundamentals versus like, oh, it's Elon Musk, and Elon Musk is good at making value for shareholders.
Yeah. I mean, that is a dangerous trap to fall into, right? I mean, you don't want to give people credit that they don't deserve, and you need to be able to back it up with something quantitative. Like, I can't just have a price target and be
Elon Musk.
this company's going to blow your mind. So just buy a lot of it. Like, you need to be able to articulate why these different revenue streams at different margins are worth what they're worth, and then defend the assumptions, or at least understand where the assumptions are wrong. Or could be wrong. I just noticed that Jess sent me a couple questions, so I want to ask
Yeah,
them before
let's do it.
we get it. So, one of them is, I think this is probably a function of it being in consumer vehicles. I don't know. So why doesn't Tesla show up in California autonomous driving data? Like the disengagements and all that stuff. Like it, they're pro are they required to?
So if they do, so California allows automakers and other companies to test full self-driving, fully autonomous driving in California under the requirement that they also report the disengagements per 1,000 miles that they have during those tests. So Tesla did this once back in like 2017 or something. They had this, really high disengagement rate relative to a company like Waymo because they were shooting their like promotional full self-driving video around the time of, when they first announced full self-driving as a thing. So they had that one report that one time, and then since then it's just like gone blank in California. So the theory is that Tesla's just doing, their full self-driving testing in other states that don't require that disclosure, because Tesla, and this is my own perspective on it, I think Tesla probably just doesn't want that being reported because of the different strategies that they're doing. You know, Tesla's going to have more disengagements right now than other companies because they're pushing the boundaries a little bit more than what other companies are doing. Like, for example, some company could go out there and they could test in a circle, just a car driving around in a circle, report those, you know, thousands and thousands of miles of doing that, say, hey, we have a super low disengagement, like invest in our company, we should be worth hundreds of billions of dollars. There's a strong incentive to do that. So I think Tesla probably views the situation as not necessarily like an apples to apples comparison, and they probably don't want those things misinterpreted. That's how I would view it if I were managing the company.
I think a lot of companies hate that disengagement data.
Yeah. Because it, you know, you have to understand the context in a simple report like that. You don't get any of that. So that's my guess on as to why.
But there's no regulatory requirement. Like they're not obliged to share the disengagement data, apparently.
I think they do. I think they are required if they do autonomous testing on public roads. So Tesla has like private stuff that they could do, you know, private roads, I'm sure that they could access and test on, or they can just go to a different state. Like they could just drive into Nevada and test there.
Well, that's the thing. Like in theory, all of their cars are sort of like, I can't remember what they call it, like ghost mode or whatever. Like if
Shadow,
you're driving
yeah.
your car around there, it's studying you, like, and it's maybe sort of fake disengaging, and or maybe it would have disengaged, but it
Right,
and
it's
it didn't.
running basically like a
It's all
constant
off to
comparison of what the
the
system would do versus what the driver has done. So that was basically, they did actually get asked about this at one point in time, and that was basically the response of like, hey, we test all our vehicles all the time in shadow mode, and we also do our own testing in other states. That was their official response. So that's kind of my guess as to why. It's not something I put a lot of weight into. Like you said, there's just, you know, probably a lot of companies don't really love that reporting, so.
Yeah. Okay, and then there was one other one here. I sort of paraphrased this one, I think, earlier. Can you talk through Tesla's ability to sell a car for full price and still be able to sell full self-driving for 40K or for 682 a month? Is there a risk that full self-driving becomes almost a standard feature for all cars by 2040?
So yeah, I would like to hear more like how you guys thought about the average selling prices and how you guys came to those final numbers.
Well, so one thing that just for the subscription stuff, what we, because they haven't disclosed anything on the subscription. And like right now, when like we have a Model X, like I think you know, and like you got the full self-driving package,
Yeah,
didn't
so I
you?
just got my Model 3 a couple months back. Got the full self-driving package.
And so we're probably gonna swap into a Model Y. And I was going through this, discussion with my wife, be like, okay, well, now the full self-driving is 10 grand. And she's like, what? You know,
Because it
like
was
we
what,
bought,
six when you bought it before?
I think it was like four. Like I don't, we bought ours in 2016. So I mean, it was a long time ago. And it was also the wrong hardware package. Like it, my Model X is too dumb. But anyway, that sounds like a lot, right? But if you think about it in terms of a subscription, the way that we decided without knowing anything about how they were going to price it is that the total lifetime payments for a subscription would be 125% what the lump sum would be. Like over time, it makes sense you're paying more. And then, so you take 10,000 times 125%, 12,500 or whatever for lifetime payments, and then divide that up into monthly increments over 6 years. And I don't know if that's right or not, but
Yeah,
in the end,
that's
it
how I would think
ends
about it too.
yeah, so it ends up being like $175 a month. So if I'm buying my Model Y, I'm trading in my X, I don't want to pay $10,000. It sounds like so much, but if it's $175 a month, like that's something that's palatable. And so that's how we thought through the subscription price. Just so people can understand sort of how the sausage was made, but it could be wrong. Pricing, I don't know specifically. Obviously, I think if all it ever does is max out at 39K for for a lump sum, then at least if you take sort of Elon Musk at his word, he will think that consumers are getting away with murder. Like that's too low, based on his sort of qualitative commentary, right? He thinks it's, just the value of that is 100K. But I don't know how he's getting to that. I don't know if he's assuming that's in like an autonomous robotaxi service or, what the uptime assumptions or what they're charging for a ride or any of that stuff. Like, I don't know how you really necessarily defend it. So we just took a very substantial haircut versus what he has said publicly is what he thinks the value is. But there's no magic there. We have done quite a bit of work on robotaxis and trying to figure out what you could potentially charge for a ride, and who knows, right? But like I said, it's not 100% take rate. Right? Like we assume it. The other thing that I think personally is that sharing kind of sucks, and driving is awesome, especially driving a Tesla, right? And I'm on the board of a car sharing nonprofit car sharing organization in the Twin Cities, and it's good. Like car sharing has its place, right? And hailing and shared auton or shared mobility and all that stuff has its place. But I just don't think that people are really gonna adopt it so with so much gusto as to completely abandon, especially when you have kick-ass products out there like what Tesla's making. Like it's fun to own these things and it's fun to drive them. And so my own personal view is that even if it is technically capable, and maybe at some point it is, mandated or it's a standard feature or something, having full self-driving capability, I think unless the government specifically tells you you can't have a steering wheel and you can't have pedals because it's too dangerous trusting human beings, I think people will still buy the, I think they'll still be a consumer purchase rather than completely shifting around to a fleet-oriented purchase, and people just want robotaxis, in my view. And so we do assume that there is some decline. Like if you look through what our long-term forecasts are for underlying automotive demand, we do assume that they start to taper and that per capita auto ownership starts going down because robotaxis and self-driving fleets start pulling some of it away. But I don't think it nukes personal car ownership in the way that some people believe. Like, I think that's a New York centric view, or maybe a San Francisco centric view, but I doubt that people in the large majority of the places in the US, at least, that are where people own cars, I don't think it'll destroy that car ownership. So, anyway, there's maybe we could spend maybe too much time talking about all the different questions that go under into all that.
Well, I do think it's interesting, and I think, I kind of think about it the same way. I don't think it's ever going to be like no one owns a car and everyone just hops on the Tesla network anytime they need to. I don't think it'll ever be like that. I do think we'll go through kind of a period where every vehicle Tesla builds will probably go into some sort of autonomy fleet until that demand is like saturated, and then the pricing can come down and they can go back to actually selling vehicles to customers that, actually want a Tesla car. And then over time, probably what you said, total automotive market shrinks a little bit, more people are sharing, but there's still going to be a market for personal vehicles.
I don't know. It'll certainly be very interesting to watch. I mean, it always is, but this is the other thing that you always hear, like management teams in this sort of autonomous vehicle realm. So I've been spending a lot of time talking to these different, self-driving car companies, LiDAR companies, autonomous truck companies, because a lot of them are coming public now through these SPACs and things like that. And there is universal, I think, envy of the fact that Tesla has been able to monetize self-driving software that is not self-driving. Like they're getting high margin revenue today. It's not like, Waymo or something. It's like you either have a self-driving network or you don't. And if you do, you have revenue. If you don't, you don't. Where this is like, no, it has a P&L impact today. They're and customers are willingly paying Tesla to become sort of R&D guinea pigs, to be out there in the world helping Tesla's network get smarter. No other company has that benefit. They can't replicate that. And so I think that regardless of where you fall on a lot of these debates, like LiDAR versus no LiDAR, or they're too aggressive on their timeline, or they're not, or simulated data versus real world data, this is one thing that everybody agrees. Like, it's ingenious. Like, they really, really wish they could have their customers just voluntarily throwing money at them to be a guinea pig. But there isn't a lot of example,
Yeah.
other
And that should speak
examples.
to Tesla's technology lead because, these other companies would love to do that. They can't do it.
Yeah, there are a lot of things. Oh, this is one thing I wanted to ask you, too.
Yeah, let me flip back to non-screen share mode because I think we're mostly done
Oh
now.
yeah, we can reference some of this other stuff if we need
Yeah.
to, like,
Let's see.
and maybe, I can try to send the report out to folks.
Okay, back to normal.
Well, I have crap, Jess, been sending me all these questions here.
That's good. We're getting some
So
questions.
how many factories do you have Tesla building? How many do you have them in 2030? How many factories do they need? How many do they have to build a year through 2030? This is actually a really good question. And it's not just as it pertains to factories, but as it pertains to CapEx in general. Rob's done a good amount of work on this. Also, there are a couple things that you can do. I know that on Rob's analysis, what he did basically was take the, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, so you can correct me if I'm wrong,
Sure.
but basically take the 3 terawatt hours of battery capacity they said they're going to have by 2030, and then divide that up. They gave like a one data point, and as always, like, there was no units on the y-axis or whatever, and so it's like, oh, there's an X percent improvement in CapEx per unit or per gigawatt hour, but you don't really know what the starting point was, and you don't, like, you can look at what maybe their per gigawatt hour price was or cost was, when they were building Gigafactory or something, and then assume that's the starting point. But I can't remember what the number, it ended up being, like, it was,
It was like 97 billion for just for
yeah,
the battery
over,
capacity.
right, just for battery capacity over a decade. And the problem I had with that number, was, first of all, we're talking today about what Tesla will be spending a decade from now, using what they said several months ago as guidance and assuming it's a stationary target rather than a moving target. Tesla itself has been unable to forecast CapEx 6, 12, 18 months in advance. And generally speaking, it's been a lot lower than what they've said initially. So, like, I thought the way that you thought through that analysis was really good. But I also think that it's too high. The other reason I think it's too high is, we don't assume they're selling 20 million cars a year by 2030.
Sure.
I mean, maybe they are. And if they are, then it's like completely game over. Like, that's obscene. And it's only half of that is for half of that battery capacity is for cars. The other half is for energy. So, I mean, like, you have to, like, take everything you know about how the economy works and just nuke it and assume that Tesla is. So we're not explicitly assuming that in the model. So we have to assume that the CapEx is lower than that.
So you're
In
maybe
terms
coming
of,
in like half of that or a third of that or something like that.
yeah, like, we're sort of zeroing in on the per gigawatt hour numbers for batteries that you had assumed and haircutting it based on what our unit forecast is for cars, and then looking at how much we assume they're going to use in energy. But I can't really do a great job of, like, this is another chapter I want to add to this. To this report is, okay, literally, like, how many stores, how many superchargers, how many battery plants, how many in-house cell factories, how many assembly plants, like, are they going to have two in China? Are they going to have two in Europe? Three in the US? like they've talked about, like they're definitely going to have two in the US. Like, what are they going to, and so I haven't thought through all of it specifically, other than just to use this sort of top-down number, like how much battery capacity will they need. I haven't defended like where specifically those plants are going to go. So it's a good question and requires a more serious answer than I can provide. Although, like, we are having them spend, you know, six, seven, and then eventually I think we have them at like $8 or $9 billion in CapEx, like in their peak years in the next, but we don't have them like 10, 10, 10, 10.
Right. The way I think about the number of factories is probably similar top-down's approach of, Tesla wants to get to 20 million. We have reports that in Giga Berlin, they're targeting something like 2 million per year's output. Texas, they've got more space there. I would assume something similar for Texas, though. So it seems like they're probably around that number. And I think, not with a ton of analysis behind this, but I think that as they approach that level of scale in an individual factory, that's probably where they view maybe the benefits of localization overwhelming the benefits of greater scale. So that's kind of how I view like the ceiling of manufacturing output from one factory. So if they're targeting 20, then I imagine they'll probably have something like 10 factories. Maybe it's, 8 to 12, but probably somewhere around 10, which I think leaves you, a couple in China, a couple in Europe, maybe three in the US, and then maybe India, wherever else.
You assume co-location, batteries, and vehicle assembly.
Yeah. Maybe
And
not in every case, because it sounds like they're going to do a battery factory in Indonesia, just kind of as a.
nickel.
They need the nickel there, so they kind of have to. But.
I think they just want the nickel and then the government asked them to do more.
Yeah.
I tried to ask this question on the earnings call and they sort of danced around it, but I think they're not gonna buy cells from other people.
They've definitely, yeah. I think near term they're gonna, but long term.
Well, that's they can't come out on the earnings call when they're this like they are dependent and they're not lying, right? Like I basically said, okay, you guys are building these like custom in-house cells that are structurally integrated into the structure of the vehicle. Other cell suppliers don't have that custom in-house cell. Like, are you gonna have them doing Tesla specific lines that are structurally integrated into the next generation of a Model Y chassis? Like that seems like it's a kind of a big ask. And they're like, no, we're cell constrained. We want cells from as many different suppliers as we can. Like, we want people to understand that we're buying more cells, not less. We want as many as we can get. If they're going to have 200 gigawatt hours of in-house cell capacity by the end of next year, they don't need anybody else.
Yeah.
But they're not going to come out on the earnings call and be like, yeah, those people are dead to us,
It is
because they
interesting
need.
though because we have had reports that, LG, Panasonic, and CATL are all working on like a 4680 type of structure. So I agree with your thought process, but it does seem like they're going down that route. So it's interesting.
I mean, like, there are a bunch of other things too, though. Like, it's not. Are they going to give them the dry electrode IP?
I
Are
don't
they
know.
just going to say, like, this is how we built our plant in California, our pilot 10 gigawatt hour plant? Build one like this that makes the exact cells that we want, even though we have all this in-house capacity coming. I don't know. Like, it. I don't. And that it's questions like that that come back to this CapEx question. It's like, okay, well, how many plants are they going to need? Where are they going to build the cells? What kind of cells are they going to build? And are they going to need to, are they, what are they going to do with Gigafactory in Nevada? Like, I still don't. Anyway, how does Tesla test its full self-driving features in places where it doesn't sell many cars or weather conditions? Or where weather conditions are different from California, since full self-driving is meant to work everywhere. Yeah, it's supposed to be like a general intelligent, like it's supposed to be functional everywhere. That is a good question though. Like, I don't, it does sound like there's definitely cultural and regional differences in terms of how people drive. There's weather differences. Like, are they going to phase in certain areas where they feel like full self-driving is more capable?
That's kind
Have
of
you
what,
heard?
yeah, that's kind of what I think. I mean, you have experience with this too, using autopilot in the winter. Like it's much, much worse. So, not to say it's incapable, but it's definitely a simpler path to just do sort of like the level four where it's, if it's snowing, it's not going to work. If, but there's still a lot of value to be had where it's not snowing. You know, that's a small part of the United States, especially in terms of population. So.
Yeah, that's how I interpret it too. Do you factor in other companies achieving full self-driving by 2030, and does that impact margins?
Is
Do you think?
that to me?
Yeah.
So this one's really interesting because, you know, Elon Musk has said many times he views the long-term competitive advantage of Tesla as their manufacturing ability rather than, you know, having autonomy or having some lead in electric vehicles in general. So it's something that's super interesting to think about. I don't know that 2030 would be that timeline, but at some point, yeah, it's going to be commoditized. And that needs to be factored in somehow.
That is it's a good point. And I'm working on some other self-driving projects for some other companies too. And like at some point, like a self-driving truck company or something, like right now, transportation is a commodity, right? Like moving things around, people don't pay for that. And there's a reason that, taxi driver or an Uber driver, like you're not, retiring early, drive an Uber. Like that service is viewed by society as a commoditized service. So if you have more than one full self-driving platform that can deliver that more or less the same service at zero incremental cost, then to a certain extent, it seems like there is kind of a race to the bottom in terms of pricing. Although if it's oligopolistic and there's only a handful of companies that are capable of achieving, regulatory compliance or societal, acceptance, then maybe that adds something to the, but again, like that's a good question to ask and to think about, like, can they really defend pricing like that far out? And maybe not. But it's, let's see. Do you think it's winner take most? I think it's winner take most, full
And
self-driving.
that's what, sorry, I'm just, my AirPod is dying here, but that's kind of what I was going to say on the last point is because, you know, there might be a company that's a few years behind Tesla, maybe a couple years behind Tesla in terms of sort of getting the capability that Tesla has. But then you still have to have the fleet. So if it's like a company like Waymo, they're still going to need to produce, you know, tens of millions of vehicles. Get them out there and then somehow, you know, have this network that Tesla's already built, and somehow they have to convince people to then switch over to their, and we're probably talking electric vehicles because you can't just have, you're not going to be cost competitive with an internal combustion engine vehicle. It's just going to be much, much more difficult to do that. So I think even if they are quick followers, they still have to get that fleet, and it's just Tesla's always going to have that. That's going to be an advantage that persists for Tesla, and they can just lower the price. So maybe it impacts the selling price, the average selling price, the revenue. But then I still think if you get in that situation, Tesla's still a great investment from where we are today.
So
That's
this
kind
is,
of how I think about it.
that's true. Like that's, a good problem to have, but and competition from some source, whether it's Apple or Amazon or GM or Volkswagen or whatever, like that's always sort of been the cornerstone of the thesis, right? Like eventually Tesla is going to have to compete against others. And like I understand that. I think that people have come around to the idea that it's maybe easier to say that than it is to actually do it. But at the same time, like there will be other companies selling cars, there will be other companies doing self-driving, robotaxis and things like that. So if you, Rob Mauer, are today, knowing everything you know about Tesla,
Sorry, Alex, I think I lost audio here. I think it just cut out. My AirPod has died. Give me a second. Okay, maybe I can hear you now. Ugh, so frustrating. I can't. I'm gonna throw these headphones on. Okay, I think I can hear you now, but I don't think they can hear you now. I can hear you now, but I don't think everyone else can hear you. All right, it's every time. Let me try one thing here. Okay, I think that might be working. I think it's
Okay,
working.
I got two people
Yeah,
on
now I
my
can't
end.
hear you.
You can't. I got two people
Gosh.
on my end saying that they can hear everything. Can you flip? No, no
Hello.
good.
I think we'll probably have to wrap it up there. They can hear you. Right now, they can hear you. They can hear me, but I cannot hear you. I'm so sorry, guys. These are the things we have to go through. How would I compete against Tesla? Right. Well, hopefully my AirPods will just charge up here while I'm answering this question. So it's interesting. I think there's not a lot of great options, right? Like Tesla's already got their scale. They've already got this lead in technology. I think the best way to compete is to focus on areas of the market that Tesla is not addressing or has no interest in addressing. So the two that immediately come to mind for me along those lines of thought are Rivian and probably Lucid. So Lucid maybe to a little bit less extent, I'll touch on them second, but for Rivian, I think what they're doing, they're focused more on like this outdoor adventure-y type of marketplace. Like I think that's been very strategic. They're also focusing on sort of this last mile delivery, which maybe that ends up competing a little bit against Tesla, but so they've got these outdoor type of vehicles, adventure type vehicles, and then they have these vans. And I think that's very clearly distinctive from the markets that Tesla is focusing on, and for good reason. So I think that gives them a lot of opportunity to play in those markets, get to scale, and then hopefully over time lower the cost. And they're not gonna ever be able to compete head on with Tesla probably, but they can at least carve out some business for themselves. The automotive market is a huge market, 80 million vehicles, 100 million vehicles a year. Even if Tesla achieves their wildest dreams, they're going to be at 20 million. They're going to have a fourth of the market. That's going to leave 75% of the market open for people to take. And Rivian positioning themselves in this way is getting themselves to a point where they have the scale where they can eventually start to enter more of those markets and try to compete, capture share. I think that's a great way to do it. Lucid, I think what they're doing, Tesla is not as focused on like this ultra luxury category. They've played in the premium price bands because they've had to just to get to where they are today because electric vehicles are super expensive. They were super expensive. So, but Tesla's never been interested in like the luxury Mercedes-Benz type of market. Lucid is now addressing that for electric vehicles. And I think they're doing, we'll see what the product ends up being, but I think it's very clearly in the strategy they're focused on luxury. So that's a differentiator from Tesla. I think when we talk about like legacy automakers, they're in a tricky spot because they can't just convert over from what they're doing now and try to compete with Tesla. BMW can't take the 3 Series and make it electric and hope to have the market share that the Model 3 does. They just can't do that. So they need to focus on things that are maybe not necessarily like their wheelhouse or what they've done historically, and that's a really tricky thing to do. So I think it's, much better for these pure play competitors than these legacy automakers. VW is maybe an exception because I think they've gotten a head start with everything that happened with Dieselgate. They can probably do more of that direct conversion than, they're positioned better for that than a lot of these other automakers are. And then I think sort of the third segment, so it's like upstarts, legacy, and then I think the the third segment you have is China, and China, you know, they're kind of a different player, and you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that too. But whether it's NIO, again, they're focused on the luxury, XPeng, they're just focused on competing head on with Tesla. And then, you know, you've got BYD and a bunch of other handful of others. And I think they've got the regulatory environment and the government support to just be able to kind of like try and compete head on, and they'll have a really long runway to try to do that. And because of that, they'll end up capturing a significant amount of share because, again, it's a huge market. So
Yeah.
those are kind of my thoughts. I'll let you respond, Alex, and I'll try to figure out how I can hear you. But hopefully the streamers can hear you.